For the next hour, we'll be doing geek news and talking about digital rights management and SHA and MD5 encryption. Confused? You won't be, or you will be. It's Friday, December 9th, 2005, 10:06 a.m. on the central coast of California, and it's time now for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today, on our program, after a spot of geek news, we are speaking with Michael McKay about encryption and digital rights management. Not encryption in digital rights management, but the issues around, the social issues around digital rights management, and a little bit about encryption, SHA, and MD5, and some vulnerabilities. During the second half of the show, I'll welcome you to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800, or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877, or you can go to geekspeak.org and click on Contact Us. I'll give out that contact information again when I invite your participation in about a half hour. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are geeks Josh Weiss, a personal geek ready for rent or lease, Miles Elam, technical trainer from Surf Control, and we also have Michael McKay, our guest. And Michael, if you'd like to participate in the news, you're welcome to do so. I'm going to start the day with Josh, unless you're being called out for your KUSP duties. Are you okay?
I'll handle it in a few minutes.
Okay, well then go ahead and start our news, sir.
Good morning. I'm going to start with a story about Wikipedia, the popular user-edited and created encyclopedia online. This week, after a couple incidents, they've had to change their rules about editing. They allow users to anonymously create and edit stories, so they don't really know, you know, who's creating things except for their own ID that they create. First, there was someone named John Siegenthaler, who was a former aide to Robert Kennedy, who said that for 132 days, the Wikipedia entry under his name claimed him as a suspect in JFK's in Robert Kennedy's assassination.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't like that. And then 2 days later...
Actually, why not?
Yeah, right. And 2 days later, former MTV VJ and podcasting pioneer Adam Curry, who we all remember from the 80s on MTV, was caught anonymously editing his own article about podcasting and basically, you know, hyping himself up and taking other people out of the article. Which, again, people didn't like. And they
don't. So what did the Wikipedia group decide to do?
Well, it's interesting. They changed the rules so that anonymous authors can no longer create articles. So you actually have to have a registered profile to create one, but you can still anonymously edit. So it's sort of a strange, you know.
Seems like, you know, it's interesting. I've heard this from so many people. I heard news about it, got it forwarded. I kind of know about geek stuff going on. So many people have talked about it.
And
to me, it's like, so? I mean, what does it take to actually be a registered user at Wikipedia?
Right.
An email address, I think.
But so, you'd be surprised, though, what a pseudonym will, like having an online personality to
what
have
it does.
Behind it,
yeah.
As opposed to a completely anonymous.
Yeah, that does make sense. But the editing means that, I mean, you could create the entry yourself with your account and make it pseudo-real, and then you could go and log out and modify it to your desires to be changed into the way that you wanted it originally without anyone knowing it was you that did it. So it seems to me kind of a weak step. And one thing that was kind of telling to me, I've always thought of Wikipedia as this wonderfully great resource, and I really rely upon it in a lot of ways for things like, you know, how do VGA's monitors work? It's really quite a wonderful resource. But then as I get together with my, you know, groups of friends, they're like, oh, Wikipedia, it's ridiculous. It always has the wrong information. People are writing books off the information in that thing, and you can't trust it and rely upon it. It's a joke. It's not an encyclopedia. So there's some real issues around
it
the content.
It depends on which things you're talking about. For more technical items,
it's
pretty
perfect.
Good.
Yeah, it's really good. Quite good.
And also, I think you're approaching it from the point of view of the user for Wikipedia. If you're the administrator to Wikipedia, you can do log analysis to see are these users coming? What groups of users are editing the same articles, and are they coming from the same IP address?
Right.
Or group of IP addresses. I mean, so there
are
things that you can do.
Yeah, I mean, a little more transparency on who is editing. I think you should restrict every editing capabilities to logged in users, and I know that's kind of against the Wikipedia idea.
Yeah, well, I mean, a lot of it comes into the social aspects. The social norm that you're putting is not perfect. People can always violate it. Just by setting the right expectations that will lead to more things going right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this also just may be a step in the direction that they're taking towards more limitations on editing, just the fact that they started here.
Yeah, well, definitely. Or maybe it's just the maturation process. At first, you just want to get as much information as you can, and now comes the vetting process.
True, right? True.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you. Thank you for that story, Josh. And you're going to go, and thank you very much for being. Maybe you'll come back. Oh, Miles, your next news story, sir?
Is
and
that...
May I say, Miles, that you look very dapper today. Go on.
See, if only you were female, I'm telling you that. See, it would have a lot more weight for me.
If only I was single and female.
Yeah, well, single. There's a new instant messenger worm that actually will chat with intended victims. This affects AOL Instant Messenger, and what it will do is it will open up a connection to a particular user and saying the statement, LOL, that's cool, and include a URL to a malicious file, in this case called clarissa17.pif.
Now, when you say it will interrupt in a conversation, like if you're having a conversation with someone else, that you know.
Well, no. What I mean is that it will pop up a message. It will.
Okay.
It will send a message, and you can then say, "Wait, is this a virus?" Like, ask the bot basically. That although you think it may be a friend of yours, you can ask them, "Is this a virus?" And it will respond back, "LOL, no, it's not a virus." If the person clicks on it, and they're using AOL Instant Messenger, it will infect their system. And then start sending out messages as them to other people in your AIM list.
So is this the first virus/bot of this nature that uses instant messaging as the communication medium?
It's not the first
medium?
Instant messenger worm, but it's, it looks to be the first of a new breed of ones that are actually engaging people in conversation.
Maybe this is where artificial intelligence
right.
will come from.
And also as a side note, when it makes connections to other people, they're hidden windows. You can't see them as a user that it's making AIM connections to... You know, other people that are in your group. Yeah. So you're actually getting an IM from what looks to be a friend of yours.
Oh, it's great. It's wrong. It's great. thank you very much for that, Miles. Josh, you're still here, so I'll let you do the next news story, sir.
So the company Creative is suing Apple as sort of a start of the media player wars or a continuation of the media player wars. Creative just put out a new player, the Creative Zen Vision. And a patent that they applied for in January 2001 was finally actually awarded to them in August of this year. And so they're going to go ahead and sue iPod because there's a very similar interface to what's actually claimed in their patent from January 2001, which was actually before the iPod even came out. So Creative is now going to sue Apple, and you know, who knows what's going to happen. You know, it sort of comes back to the whole intellectual property thing in a way, this, you know, this design that they came up with in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And what's going to happen.
It's amazing. This is something that I wonder about, because back in the late 90s, I guess 97, 98, I was first introduced to MP3s. So here you have music, and then you need an interface to play music, like, say, a playlist, and then a way to access it. And so you would make a device that would have MP3s and then play them.
Are you
them.
Trying to say that all of this is just kind of, it's not that unique and innovative?
I mean, let's call a spade here.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
It's music and you want to listen to it, and there's only so many ways that you're going to organize music to play it.
Yes.
And admittedly, you know, the iPod little touch, you know, and inductive touch, you know, roller is kind of cool going through.
Innovative
and,
even.
Yeah, but... You're still going through a playlist. You're still right. going through a list of songs.
Well,
I mean, all we're doing is the user
interface. Is amazing to me.
There needs to be kind of, well, the patent. I mean, there's definitely issues with the U.S. Patent Office and how patents are distributed and enforced.
I mean, it's not as bad as software patents.
Yeah,
but,
of course.
I mean, it's, yeah.
All right, Miles, next story, sir. Thank you, Josh, very much for that. And I think we're gonna make this the last one, so make it a really good one. No pressure.
The last one. Okay, here's a conceptual item that has come up. It is the RSS stream reader.
The RSS what?
RSS stream.
What is
so
that?
So RSS...
Okay, next story.
Yeah, and, like, you know, this is that truth is stranger than fiction.
Okay.
Now, someone is actually looking at making a RSS feed reader that will print out on toilet paper. So while you're in the bathroom, information just comes in.
You know
in.
What? Okay, stop. Okay, take that piece of paper and push it aside. What's the next story? I don't want that to be the last. I don't even want to know that it's there. I'm going to edit that out of the podcast.
A fork of the Linux distribution Ubuntu. has been officially released, and it is called Edubuntu, and it is targeted for 5 to 12-year-old children and their parents.
Maybe I should pay attention. Okay.
It is a Linux distribution that has a collection of games and learning tools put onto a single distribution. In other words, you take a CD, plop it into your computer, and you have all
the
stuff.
And does it boot off that CD?
I believe it is available as a
live
CD.
So, first off, Linux is an operating system, kind of like Microsoft or Windows operating system. Mm-hmm. It's free, and you can download this and use it. And the idea
is a free download.
And the idea here is that you can download this operating system that will be a standalone computer for a child. And that sounds really wonderful. So,
and it's available for PCs running standard Intel-compatible processors and also for the AMD 64, the 64-bit processors.
Sure.
And folks on over.
Yeah, and everyone, here's an image that looks really nice.
Right. But basically, it's a group of tools. For example, basic geography, spelling.
I love it. Okay, we'll try it out at my house with my 4-year-old, and who's very advanced, so it'll work for him. and give a feel for how it is. Thank you very much, Miles. Josh.
And the URL is www.edubuntu.org.
Don't you love hearing, especially like when you're driving, don't you love hearing URLs on the
right.
radio? You're like, oh, cool, yeah. I'll never remember that. But
if you care about your child, you will.
Well, now I'm writing it down. I see cars pulling over all over the place. So, Edubuntu.
Edubuntu. Edubuntu.
Thanks, Miles. You're listening to Geek Speak. That's Miles Elam. Also, Josh Weiss is here. We're doing Geek News, and now we're going to switch over to welcome our guest, Michael McKay. Welcome, Michael.
Well, thank you.
See, I told everybody I would do that. Michael is a programmer, father, and social aware geek. Michael's experience and interest include security encryption and social issues about digital rights management.
And because he loves his kids, he's going to remember Edubuntu.
Edubuntu. If you love your children.
He has paper in front of him.
So, Michael, thank you for joining us here today. I know that I think all of us here are more interested in talking about digital rights management, which we will get into, but I do want to cover the MD5 and SHA encryption thing, because it's so fun to talk over everybody that listens to the show. So, let's... basically, recently, some mathematicians figured out that SHA and MD5, which are used in things everywhere, security...
Maybe we should back up and tell people like what they're for, not just...
Michael McKay, what are SHA and MD5 for?
All right. Well, they are cryptographic algorithms, and they're of a class called cryptographic hashes.
Good. That cleared everything up, Miles. No, I'm sorry. Go on.
So, as usual, you know, you give you the answer you asked for.
Yeah,
now
I know.
What do
we use them for, and why are they used?
So they are part of they're used they're a tool in a cryptographic algorithm, and essentially, a cryptographic hash is something that can be used to help take a lot of information, and you come up with a fingerprint of that information.
Okay.
The computer scientists in the audience, it's a hash.
Right. So the idea behind it is anything you want, you can turn into something that's a small representation key of it. So
as opposed to
recognize it later.
Yeah, if I may. As opposed to a two-way encryption algorithm, in other words, you're encrypting on one end and then decrypting on the other. In other words, encrypting your email so that only a certain person could decrypt it. MD5 and SHA-1 are what are called one-way hashes. One-way encryption algorithms, and that you cannot get the original back from the hash. It
right.
is, as he said, just a fingerprint. It's just
okay.
A
yeah. So one of the ideas of a cryptographic hash.
Wait. We now know what it is. I mean, it's some mathematical algorithm that makes a unique thing out of something else. But what is it used for? Why do we need them?
It's actually used in quite a few places. Let me just talk about perhaps one of the most common uses, which is it's part of a digital signature. Let's say that I was going to write something and I wanted to digitally sign this paper that I'd written to establish that it came from me.
Okay.
This is typically done using public key algorithms like RSA, and those algorithms are very computer intensive. So as a result, what you typically don't do is you don't sign the entire document. Well, you run the document through one of these cryptographic hash routines, and then you sign the resulting hash.
Okay. So there's not as much math going on.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And there are some other reasons as well. I could probably spend a whole...
Let's not. Go on.
Right. So basically, the concept then is that the cryptographic hash, if it works perfectly, and of course, in the real world, nothing works perfectly, but if it works perfectly, if you change one little bit in
the original document
that comes down, then you will get a completely different hash output.
And the idea would be something like, you know, if someone wanted to... you wrote an article and it was put up somewhere, and then someone copied that and said that it was your article, and then they modified it to say something like, you know, Miles doesn't know what he's talking about, but you never said that, then, because why would you? No one would.
Yeah.
So then that key would no longer identify that message. It would not match, and people would know that you never
that
signed
it. That had been
tampered. Okay.
Yep. The real obvious, the typical example is I'm writing a check for $10 to you, and I sign it cryptographically, and you decide that you want to get more than $10. You change it to $10 million.
I do that all the time. Huh?
And then the cryptographic check would no longer validate.
Right. And neither would your bank, really.
And why would you use this? I mean, this is, for example, back in the day you had paper.
I heard about that.
And you sign your name. And it's supposed to be, this is that signature that says this.
Okay.
But with the advent of Photoshop, with the advent of photocopiers and things like that, you can play around with it. And this
electronic mail messages.
Right.
You see,
so,
I mean, I see MD5s all the time in a very similar form where you're going to download... you're going to download an application installed on your computer. And next to the on the website, there's the link for the application, and then on to the right, there's an MD5 link, and you can download it. And then when you get it to your personal computer, you can run an algorithm on it that should give you that same text that's on the website to confirm that what you got to your computer was the same as what they were trying to give you.
Yep, that's right. Exactly right.
If you're using the same algorithm on both ends.
It works. Okay, that's so right. that's the 20-minute simple version of the... what happened with these? What happened recently to this, this
okay,
idea?
Well, actually, probably the most dramatic results have been coming from some Chinese mathematicians, but there's been a number of other work being done in this field as well. One of the properties that you look for is something called collision resistance. So that is, how easy is it, if I can control the input going into this cryptographic hash, mm-hmm. how easy is it for me to find another input that gets the same hash?
Right.
And if you think about it, there is always going to be some overlap. Because,
right, because
you may be taking, a million bytes of code and putting it down into 160 bits.
And MD5 is like 48-bit or something on those lines? Your input is almost always going to be larger than the key.
Okay, yeah. That's the thing that's really quite important, and that's the thing that, you know, all data on computer systems are just a number. I mean, you can simplify everything down to one number, and that's, you know, the size of the data, if you will, is a number. So if you are taking a number and you make it smaller, which you do with this key, this signature, the signature is always smaller, or almost always, there's definitely a possibility of having multiple larger numbers turn into smaller. The issue is that it would be such... the data would be so different that you would know. Like, it wouldn't even be English, for example, is one of the thoughts. So what have they found in being able to create a secondary
match? Yeah. So the idea is that it's actually very computationally intensive to try to find those matches. There's something called the birthday attack, which essentially, if you... a SHA-1 has a result of 160 bits. Because of the birthday attack, you can probably find a match in 2 to the 80th. That's a very large number. You might have heard 2 to the 80th attempt.
Yeah, which means it becomes an 80 bit as opposed to 100.
Right. So.
Oh yeah, of course. Right.
You might have heard that.
Whenever you say like 2 to the 80th or 2 to the 40th, whatever, those are the number of on and off switches, the number of bits.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
Well, in this case, I'm talking about what's the exhaustive attack. So if you were to go off and just start trying things randomly, how long would it take you to do things?
Okay.
And you might have heard that. The DES algorithm, another encryption algorithm that's used in banking, has fallen to exhaustive attacks. And that's a 2 to the 55 attack. And nowadays, with very specialized hardware, they can do that in about a day.
So what you're saying is that encryption's been kind of, they've stopped, people know it's not that secure, and it takes, you can do it in a day, and that's 2 to the 55th. And what you're saying is SHA now is 2 to the 80th, which
well,
is a lot less.
Ideally, it's 2 to the 80th.
Okay.
And so that's still...
You could break it faster than a day.
Well, 2 to the 80th is very substantial.
Okay.
What you have to remember is every time you go up from 2 to the 55 to 2 to the 56, it doubles the length of time.
Right.
So 2 to the 80th is still a considerable factor better than 2 to the 56.
Okay.
So what has happened now is that by analyzing SHA-1, they have... SHA-1 is the more interesting results. MD5 is an older algorithm. It's in kind of the same family. And it's been known to be a little bit weaker.
Let's do SHA-1. What's the SHA-1?
So by analyzing some of the weaknesses in SHA-1, they have come up with a method of having the collision occur.
Making two different entries turn into the same hash. Uh-huh.
And they've got it down into about the 2 to the 60th range.
Okay.
So this is doable, and they have produced about 3 or 4 SHA-1 attacks doing that.
Miles?
Well, but there's a caveat to that, which is you can find two different files that will... You can find that collision, but then there's also the added thing, for example, when downloading software, that they have to be exactly the same length, and they have to be executable code. In other words, the right format. So to make that is still...
Yeah,
tremendously difficult.
Yeah, I mean, so when this is not to say that SHA-1 is broken and that everyone should stop using it
right
away.
But mathematically, it's very intellectual and interesting.
But what happens is that mathematically, it's showing some signs of weakness. This is not supposed to happen.
Right.
And there are actually some practical attacks. I've seen an example of a PostScript coding where they've managed to, they're taking advantage of the fact that when you have a PostScript file, you don't, it's interpreted by a computer, so people don't really look at the whole thing. So they've managed to essentially take some dead area in the PostScript file and use that to expand upon the hash so that you can get two PostScript files that are different, but both have the same signature.
Right. Interesting.
But, but in fairness, they were starting with the thought of trying to break that, and so they were making the PostScript both the original and the copy is.
Well, as I feared, and it definitely happened, we got into the technical terms of SHA, and fascinating stuff. I really love it.
SHA, which also stands for Simple Hash Algorithm.
And it is simple. It is so simple. That now I feel like I know more than I ever wanted to know, and I know that everyone else does. So let's go on to, for a minute and a half until we go into break, but let's go on to digital rights management. Why are you concerned about digital rights management in this day and age?
Well, digital rights management is essentially a form of copy protection, and it's probably a fancy term because there are other aspects of copy protection. But I have a couple of concerns. One is that we have the government in here meddling around, passing laws that aren't very well thought out. And so in some cases, kind of the libertarian aspect, I think that I'd be happy to see DRM products go out and get an honest acceptance or rejection from the marketplace. But with the government, it kind of makes it a little bit harder to have that happen. And the other part is there's recently been a whole rash of security bugs around a particular DRM schemes that Sony BMG has been using on their CDs.
So we've talked a lot about the Sony problem on air on GeekSpeak.
Right. Okay, so I've got some more information on not only the XCP issue, which you've talked about, but also an alternative scheme that Sony uses, the Suncom's MediaMax. And
let's talk about that in just a moment. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. This afternoon on News and Notes from NPR, our longtime employees of the Department of Justice Civil Rights Division under pressure to pursue a conservative agenda, plus versatile actor Jeffrey Wright talks about his new movie, Serena. That's this afternoon on News and Notes from NPR, starting at 3 p.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. And this is Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the room with me, Michael McKay, our guest, talking about now digital rights management. And two of the geeks are here, Josh and Miles. And we are going to take your calls today. We'd love it to be on topic about digital rights management and issues about your content and who owns what. The numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. You can visit the internet, go to geekspeak.org, and click on Contact Us. This program is supported by a grant from Cruzio, providing local and nationwide internet services, including DSL 6.0, spam filters, and virus protection. Information about Cruzio memberships available online at cruzio.com or by calling 459-6301. All right. Let's keep going with digital rights management, and please feel free to join us on GeekSpeak today if you've got questions about or issues, or you want to kind of vent a little bit about how stuff that you traditionally think of as owned by you is actually controlled and managed by others. It's kind of an odd concept. It's new. And so you were saying that the Sony thing, let's go into a little bit of that. Yeah, so what else do you know about it?
Let's recap on on the Sony issue for those who haven't heard. Sony has done a recall of a number of CDs.
More than a million, I think.
Yeah, that use a type of copy protection that they call XCP. And
that's just their name of the process in which they try to protect people from copying their content. Okay.
Right. And so the reason why what prompted the recall is that XCP uses some technique to cloak itself from the operating system. If you do a listing of files, they actually go into the operating system and modify it so that the operating system won't report that a file is there. It also, it's running a process, and it goes into the operating system, and it modifies the operating systems that if you give a list of everything that's running on your computer, it won't show the processes that are running.
And these practices are typically used in what's called rootkits, ways to crack into people's computer and do things.
Or so this is what a rootkit is.
This is what a rootkit is.
Yeah, that is precisely a rootkit.
So that's a rootkit. They have it, and
right.
What's
and so there are any number of bad things about this. One of them is that it takes up about 3 or 4% of your CPU, or at least that's one of the test figures I've seen. It has some bugs in it, so it can actually cause your computer to crash. Which,
or rather, in practice, it has caused some vulnerabilities.
Right, and then another part. Right, there's been some virus writers who've taken advantage of the rootkit, and so they've managed to do some things on your computer that you wouldn't expect, just simply because you're running this rootkit that was supplied to you by Sony.
And one of the big things is that, of course, as a Sony customer, you put that CD in, you weren't aware that this was actually even going on, so it was happening under
the
pretext.
Right, and so those are all the
that's
parts
what we've been reporting on, but you've lovely you've wrapped that up very nice and neat,
right.
And I think I'm going to take that as a soundbite. So
okay.
Go on.
So there are actually a couple of other issues. They've had some bugs. So for example, if you try to install the uninstaller that Sony provided to you, it actually sets your web browser wide open to malicious attacks. People can essentially
hate it when that
take over your computer through your web browser.
Okay.
Because of the.
Because you never heard of that happening before. I'm sorry.
let's at the moment say they have a EULA. This is the little
end user license agreement.
He smiles. I was like, whoa.
Yeah,
that's pretty personal of you to say. Go on. So,
so that shows up, and it kind of spills out the terms of what they expect you to do, what they promise to do, and so on. Well, in this EULA, of course, they didn't mention the fact that they were installing this rootkit. They also, in the EULA, say that they are not going to send information off to Sony, and that's actually not true.
They do send.
Every time you play the CD, it sends off a little unique identifier off to Sony. And they even have, it's unimplemented, but they have a method to send advertisements back to them, to you.
And from what I hear, there was also another aspect to it, which was if the rootkit was installed either way, but if you said no to the end-user license agreement?
That's a different one.
Oh, it's a different one.
Okay. So that's XCP, and that's the one that people have heard about.
That's the big one. That's on millions of CDs.
Yeah.
And,
okay. Well, there's one that's actually even more widely distributed, which is the Suncom Media Max. And that's the one that you were just talking about, Miles.
Okay.
And so it pops up with the EULA, and the EULA says, do you agree to this term, yes or no? What's bad about this one is that even if you click no, it still installs the copy protection software.
It's just disabled.
Yeah, it's just, well, no, actually, it's not disabled. It under some conditions, it's present, but they don't start up the process. But then there's it's very likely if you ever put the CD in again, whether you play it or not, it will start up the process. So it
excellent.
And that came out so, long before the XCP.
Okay,
right?
So yeah. there's a delivery.
Oh, and just to go on,
yeah.
It also mysteriously enough, despite what its EULA says, does phone home with information every time you play it on
okay.
Sony.
Now, what's interesting about this for me is that for so long there's this. Oh, but if there's digital control over stuff that I have on my computer, if the V chip exists on my television, corporations are going to take care, you know, do things to my machine and my life because they're evil corporations. And you know, to some degree, you're like, oh, conspiracy theory. Is it really going to happen? Who cares? I mean, the company's going to want to protect their own interests, and that is to make sure the customer's happy, blah, blah, blah. And here's an example, a perfect example of that totally becoming true. Sony took advantage of all its customers under the guise of protecting its own copyright, damaging their computers, making it unsafe. I mean, it's all true, and it's kind of, that's what has made this story so darn fascinating. So this phoning home part is really telling, but one thing I wanted to ask you about. Well, you know what? Let's let other people participate in this conversation. We do have some people online, and we'll go ahead and go to Cecile. This is from Watsonville, our southern co-patriot in Santa Cruz County. Hello, and welcome to Geek Speaks, Cecile.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for being on. What's your question about DRM?
Well, I have a kind of two-part question. I work for a company that does published materials, print materials.
Wow.
And we're thinking of going to electronic, but we're concerned about people, you know, taking our stuff and stealing it.
And stealing it meaning that...
That they might copy spreadsheets and reuse them in some other way. Or
what is your product that in printed form, why is it, what is it?
Well, right now we're doing newsletters, books, and reports.
Okay, so you have fresh content all the time about stuff that's interesting to people.
Yes.
And you're printing that right now and distributing it through mass mailing kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay, and you're concerned that if you, and I'm assuming that's a paid service of some kind?
Yes.
So you're getting money. Mm-hmm. So now what you're doing is you're going to switch over to maybe emailing PDF documents, post Adobe's open format, if you will, for digital files.
Actually, we already are emailing them.
Okay, and now you're concerned that people might email them to other people that aren't even on the subscription list.
Or copy material for them and use them.
So, yeah. So this is a pretty example of, this is, if you will, the soapbox that is used to say digital rights management is extremely important. Because, of course, for your business model, it's very important.
Yes.
Michael? So let's Cecile, what's specifically your question? How do you make it only do certain things? Is that what you want to
do? Well, one of the things that came up yesterday was, is there some way that, say, somebody could open it five times, but then the sixth time it would disappear? And
okay.
I would also think about copying. I know if you have a PDF, but if you have, you know, Adobe Acrobat, you could break into the PDF and take things out.
You can
or
do that, yeah.
Screenshots.
Okay,
right?
Well, let's let Michael address this.
Okay.
Michael, here's someone that wants to use MD5 for their business model. Or I'm sorry, RDM wants to use digital rights management to protect their business practice or their new business practice. How do they go about this?
Well, I mean, we'll just first off by saying that this is very difficult.
I mean, you know, that's why I asked
yeah,
you.
One of the problems with DRM is that, in effect, it is a speed bump. Because as soon as it goes from the computer to being turned into sound or goes up on the screen,
mm-hmm.
then you can take a picture of it. I mean, there's any
right.
number of ways that you can go off and do that. So, at best, digital rights management is going to be some kind of speed bump. And it's really, I think, one of the things that's happened in Hollywood and the music industry is that it's been oversold as to just how good it is.
Mm-hmm.
So ultimately, you can take various measures. I mean, for example, Adobe has some built-in methods that I think they're extra cost, but that you can use to try to control the PDFs and, for example, not allow people to do a cut and paste from the PDF.
Uh-huh.
So, And unfortunately, it's easy to get past that.
You just use Illustrator, Adobe Illustrator.
Well, yeah.
Or you open it up on a Mac and save it separately.
Right.
You do file conversions. You actually go into the file itself.
Or download any of the utilities that are on the net.
Or you screen print it.
You break the encryption of the file and you change the permission bit.
The speed bump is very small for the people in the room here.
Right.
So you could use an Adobe solution, but it's not going to really stop anything. Well, what else can you do?
Really, what it really comes down to is, I think it's a combination of business model.
Yeah.
How is it that you make money? And there's some technology tools that can help you out, but don't
rely upon them.
Yeah.
And I actually have a devil's advocate from the other side. You were talking about how can you get it so that people can read it 6 times and then it goes poof, but does that happen with print media? I mean, when you mail out a
child or a dog, it does.
Well, yeah. But I mean, like mailing out a printed letter.
Yeah.
You know, that someone may have that for 50 years, and they may show that to someone else.
And in a traditional business model, it's very common for people to share. Right. They read an article, then they pass it off to somebody else.
Right. So I do have that. I mean, there's that. I guess that back and forth of, yes, people should have a right to make money or to be able to make a living off of their creation.
And I want to say something about, and I want to kind of add to what Miles is saying, that in situations where I've seen PDFs be distributed, there's this great example of this operating system that I use, or this environment that I use called Ruby on Rails, and they produced this book, and the developers that produced the book made this book, Ruby on Rails, and if you bought the book before it was actually published, they sent you a PDF of the book. And they just been really clever. They just embedded in the bottom of every single page on the PDF the person who actually bought the book's name. This belongs to so-and-so. Someone could, you know, open that up, edit that name out of every single file, resave it, and distribute it again. But that speed bump was perfect because it basically said, you know, you own this, and it's personalized for you, and don't share it. I mean, it wasn't restrictive. You could share this file, you could copy this file. But it just kind of participated in give knowledge to the user that it's for them. I think that is the most effective, for me right now, way of protecting.
That's an overt one. Uh-huh. And then it also makes me think about watermarks. Watermarks being something that it's not immediately visible or not immediately apparent, and yet it's something that just alters the content just a little bit.
That helps you
just to give it a fingerprint.
Because what we're dealing with is there isn't a simple solution. Sony screwed up, right? I mean, and they're putting a lot of money into it, so it's not easy to do what you want to do. But maybe what you want to do is think, okay, here's another thing that I find really frustrating about digital rights management. People that make the new stuff, they want to share it with the world, they want to make money from it, they'll put these speed bumps in there, and traditionally the technology hasn't been smooth. So now someone buys the product from you, the customer, the person you're trying to service, right? And they have to go through all these weird complicated steps to read that article, and then slowly over time the software changes, and then they no longer can read that article. I had a friend that has an old computer just because he bought stuff that he can only read on that computer because of digital rights management. It's messing with your end customer. And I would say stay away from that as much as possible. Don't make it hard for the person that is paying you money. Because if you make it easy, just like
the iTunes
music store has done, it's really easy to buy stuff from them. People buy. So I think that's an important aspect. I do want to go on to more calls.
Everyone's on their soapbox now.
Yeah.
I'm sorry about that.
Cecile, I hope that we kind of helped you out in thinking about this. Did we?
Yes, you did very much.
Good answer.
I appreciate the back and forth flow.
And it was so—it's so nice to talk to someone who needs digital rights management, and they're really thinking about it from perspective of their business. And thank you very much for calling.
Thank you.
Bye bye.
Bye.
All right, Paula Colorado Canyon, Heidi, welcome to GeekSpeak.
Hi. This is not on your topic, but. Santa Claus said that he would bring me a digital camera for Christmas.
And did it happen yet?
Well, I'm in the market, so.
So you're not relying on Santa Claus, but it's definitely going to happen.
No, I'm relying on Santa Claus.
Okay.
I've gone to the different websites, and there's just way too much information for me.
It sure is.
What I want, what I need it for is a painter, and I'm copying my paintings.
For print again? Are you
just copy work for
just
a portfolio.
Okay,
basically.
So and is it a print portfolio?
It may be. Use it for that.
Because the reason I ask is things like lots of times galleries will want to see still even. They'll want to see your slide reel, right? They'll want slides of all your work. Trying to do that with a digital camera is just going to be really too expensive for you.
Right. So I may be printing something out, but it won't be a large print.
Right. Okay. So, you know, 8.5 by 11 kind of, you know, on a printer kind of thing, or maybe
right,
some prints. Okay.
Right.
Well, I mean, you know, it's definitely possible. You can't really buy a digital camera right now that can't do a print that size and have it look good. But you've got issues of color and because
clarity.
You want the clarity, and you want that to match your painting perfectly. And once you start,
right,
that's really hard. But the digital camera is actually a small part of it, because most of that's done in Photoshop and then what print bureau or what printer you're using, and there's a whole process about that. And we'll, every, you know, fourth month or something on GeekSpeak, we'll talk about digital photography. We do
so
that.
So my main...
What's your basic question?
Let me tell you just what my main concern is here, is to reproduce the color without doing Photoshop, because someone else will be doing that. Or I hear you can go to Costco and you get good prints that way.
Mm-hmm.
I need... a camera with a tripod mount, mm-hmm, an optical zoom that's between 35 and 100 millimeters, a macro feature, and then I need a monitor.
Do you need a macro feature because you want to be able to do close-ups of the work?
Right, uh-huh, or small work or something, uh-huh, like that. And then a monitor that's fairly good size so I can square up the paintings.
The display, uh-huh.
Well, so that I can, they need to be perfectly flat and
okay,
square.
All right. This is a great question, and I have a really easy answer for
okay,
you. I don't know. And I love that answer because it's so, you know,
I'm
so revealing.
Someone, article in the paper recommended a PowerShot 610.
Great. I love it. Good camera.
Yeah.
Okay, a couple things. You're not going to... Okay, the source I use for digital cameras is dpreview.com.
Okay.
It's one of those ones that has way too much information.
Right.
But they really do have good reviews up there. And they have got forums up there. So dpreview.com, let's use that as the primary source for your photography needs.
Okay.
You have a great situation where you do not care how long, on your primary use, you don't care how long, once you push the button to this shutter release and actually taking a photograph. That's important because most cameras can't do that very fast, and it's really frustrating. So you don't need like an SLR camera, a really expensive thing. But what you do need is something that doesn't have a lot of warping from the lens, you know, because what I take photographs all the time of mother's work. You can go to troxel.com/write to see her work if you'd like. And when doing that, it's what's very common is the photograph will be askewed because you're not perfectly straight on, or the lens will cause the sides to be slightly warped. What I normally do is go into Photoshop and remove the frame, so I cut off a little bit of the painting. It looks all perfect because a little aberration on a painting you don't really notice. But that's not an option for you. So that's going to be a real challenge. I don't have the out-of-the-box solution for you on how to do this, but hopefully up at DP Review, the forum section does. The next thing to do is talk to other artists that have cameras and find out how they do it. So,
okay.
So the short answer, I don't know, was a good one, and there's a nice long answer that means the same thing. Thank you very much, Heidi, for the
all
call,
right,
and
thanks.
I'm sorry I can't help you more. Why can't things be easy in the world? it's so telling.
Well,
isn't
no, it's a great answer. Like, I don't know, but here's where you can find out, because these are people that would.
Yeah, but we have a radio show, and when we're saying we can help you technically.
Well, yeah,
point
but you just pointed her toward a resource so that other people can look at it.
It's true.
Yourself up,
you know, the optical zoom is a really good point, actually, because the more zoomed in you get, the flatter, if you will, the image is, and that's what you want when you're taking a picture like that. Okay, we got one more call on, and it's to topic, so we'll go ahead and take it. From Santa Cruz, Brent?
It is indeed.
Hello.
Hi. Just so that people know, besides being a chief engineer of the radio station, I also write computer security software to protect people's programs. So I want to make a couple comments on the Sony thing. We've had to ban Sony BMG CDs from our studios because we sometimes grab CD tracks in order to put them in promos and stuff.
Okay, first off, you're the main engineer for KUSP, which
right,
is a radio station everybody's heard of,
yeah,
and especially everybody that's listening right now. And in the room with me is, how many CDs are here in the air room?
A zillion.
Yeah. Okay, so a zillion CDs. There's basically every three walls.
Yeah, for the audience, we are surrounded by CDs right now.
Yeah, it's really kind of eerie.
Floor to ceiling.
There's also, of course, traditional albums here as well,
right.
You know, vinyl. But in any case, the CDs are in the air room, and there's thousands and thousands of them in this room with us. And none of these are Sony CDs?
Well, probably some of them are, and they play fine in a regular CD player.
Okay. And that's what we use normally when playing stuff on the
station. Right,
but
what we do when we make promos and stuff is we have to bring it over to a digital editing system, which means a hard disk. So we have to bring it over to the computer system.
And that's running Windows XP.
And it's running
Windows 2.
Various and sundry forms of Windows.
Okay, and the issue is that if you put it in there, Sony totally messes with the system and can potentially take down some of the wonderful content you hear every day on KUSP.
It could conceivably take down our whole system for a great length of time,
right.
And we wouldn't know what was going on. Because they're trying to hide it with their whole rootkit thing.
Right. So you hate it, right?
Pardon me?
You hate that they did this?
More than I can tell you.
On air.
Sony has typically been the more evil of corporations in trying to do content management.
Uh-huh.
Their original mini-disc recorders,
you could not
export anything from the mini-disc
to a computer. It's still hard to do that. You still have to do all these things to get it. It's so frustrating. You get a digital recording device, you record your friends, your neighbors, anything you want to record, your daughter's first birthday, which, by the way, it's my daughter's birthday today, Gwendolyn.
Happy birthday.
And you record that on this little mini-disc, and then you've got to play it out through the headphones and re-record it on your computer, even though it's a digital file. So frustrating. So Sony's been evil. Okay, so go on.
So that's where we're at as far as the radio station and my other radio clients. I've just had to tell people you just need to not use these guys' CDs.
Okay.
And Sony shoots themselves in the foot for this because we're one of the primary ways that people get to hear their music. And if we don't play it, people don't hear it.
Yay! So this is a perfect example of what I was just explaining to our caller, and I'm forgetting her name now, Cecile, I think.
Cecile, yes.
That if you make roadblocks like this, it's going to damage the customer's use of it, and they're not going to want to use it. And that's it's exactly what's happening right now. All of a sudden, Sony CDs aren't being played on KUSP, which means no one can hear it on the Central Coast of California. That's pretty severe. So
right.
Go on, Brent.
And I have personally decided that I'm in the market for a new laptop, and I am not going to buy a Sony laptop because I have no idea what they've put on the darn thing.
Right.
Now, and with my other hat on as a guy that writes proprietary security software, I have fallen into this same trap that Sony fell into, in that I designed software to protect a very expensive proprietary program. And in the process of development, the long story short is that they started installing the software at the customers, and they couldn't use this $100,000 piece of software that they bought.
Right.
Because of security problems.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so...
Well, Brant, thank you so much for first of all...
I don't want to take all your time.
Yeah, I'm gonna go on because I do want to talk more with Michael, and thank you very much for calling.
Okay.
Brant also sent us an email, and I'll just sum it up real quick. Last week we talked about, or maybe 2 weeks ago, we talked about broadband over power lines and how it could damage ham radio. Well, Brant says that actually it modifies and just adds noise to any AM signal, which means AM radio in general is degraded, if you will, by having broadband over power lines. But I thank Brant also for that. And, Michael, let's go on to more issues of DRM, because I know there's let's talk about the kind of the social, the concept behind it that, well, go, I'll let you take it.
I probably first heard this from the people who created the DivX DVD system that failed spectacularly a few years back. But the general idea was they're talking about early electricity was measured per lamp. So the Edison company would say, okay, I have 5 lamps in my house, therefore I'm going to charge you a certain amount.
My light bulb, basically.
Yeah, my light bulb.
You mean there was no metering, right?
That's right.
That's how you knew.
Okay. So then someone invented the power meter, and that's actually probably one of those great geek things people don't think about, but it was very difficult to do. And after that, they could actually charge you for the amount of electricity that you used as opposed to the capacity.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
So the whole idea that the DivX DVD guys had was that instead of giving you a large charge, we can just charge you for a little bit.
Micropayments.
That you use.
Huh?
Exactly. And so it sounded like a great idea. And what it really comes down to is the trust that you have on the people who are giving you the charge. And so as you've obviously heard, Sony here has lost
some trust.
So
the idea being that you get a movie from this service, and then if you play it, you know, 15 times, you get paid for it. You pay for it 15 times, and if you pay for it once, you
right.
Pay for it. But the thing is, it's all kind of in the background, and who knows? They could charge you 100 times, and right.
Right. Right. And what other kind of limitations that are going in?
Sure.
So one of the interesting points about XCP is you may have also heard that it had a copyright violation of its own. There was some public source.
This is the first of the two Sony installed rootkit solutions. XP. What is it called?
XCP.
XCP. And you're saying that the software itself was violation of some other agreement?
Right. They took some computer software that didn't allow, basically mistreated the license for that open source computer software. And it actually turns out that it was dead code. They weren't using it. But the reason it was there was to allow them to tie into Apple iTunes and be able to essentially tie into the Apple DRM. So it's kind of interesting.
It was open source software that was made to hack the DRM encryption
right.
on iTunes songs.
Right. And so what they did is they incorporated that in so they could take either translate the iTunes songs into their own DRM scheme or translate their DRM scheme into the Apple iTunes FairPlay.
But they haven't implemented that yet.
It was turned off.
Okay.
So it was dead. It was there, but they weren't using it. And so one of the questions is, why would you do that? I mean, and what it really came down to, Sony, we think one of the reasons that Sony didn't actually turn on that feature was you might recall that Sony was asking their customers to petition Apple to allow Sony to participate using Apple's iTunes. Apple has a huge share of the legal downloaded music, mm-hmm. and it looks like Sony was using the DRM as a method of pressuring the customers to try to reduce Sony's Apple's market share.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you start getting corporate warfare going on
through your machine,
through DRM,
and what you own.
Your machine.
What is the digital copyright? I mean, one of the things we were talking about when the Sony thing happened is that if you try to disable or you know remove this virus and or not virus but this rootkit from your system, you're interfering with the copyright that somebody's put in place to protect their content. And the Digital Rights Millennium Act really clearly says if you mess with it, you're breaking the law. So
yeah, I think that's probably a good reminder. If you want to take one thing home from this show, that is go talk to your congressman and try to get them to change the DMCA around. Basically,
the Digital Millennium Copyright Act.
Copyright. Uh-huh. Yeah. That's a law passed by Congress in 1998. And essentially, this findings on Sony were delayed by about a month and a half because the researchers at Princeton had to consult with personal lawyers, they had to consult with Princeton's lawyers,
mm-hmm.
because there is a law out there that essentially, even if you have bad things happening to your computer, it makes it of questionable legality for you to research it.
Right. So these university people could not safely investigate what they had bought from Sony and installed on their own computers without being concerned that Sony could win a court case against them if they published their findings or did what they were doing because of the Digital Millennium Copyright.
Exactly. And so
Digital Millennium Copyright is turning into this thing that really restricts people from figuring out what's going on, and that's a scary thing. All right, so that's the soapbox point is contact your congressman, get rid of Digital Millennium Copyright, have it modified to make it work better for the society we actually live in, and what that will look like is anyone's guess to some degree. Well, we have, as we do every week on Geek Speak, finished a show. That's how it happens when you start a show. You seem to finish it. Today we had a group of people, and I want to thank all of you. Josh Weiss is available for rent or hire as a consultant. You can go to geekspeak.org to send him a message. Miles Elam is a technical trainer at Surf Control. My guest today, Michael McKay, is about to work at Microsoft. Talk about the big corporation. And we won't get into what that is, but what you're doing and everything, maybe we'll have you on later when they're more interested in you talking about it. But I really want to thank you for being so interested in DRM and always keeping me abreast of what's going on. And, of course, on the complications and confusions of MD5 and SHA. And thank you very much, Michael, for being here today. GeekSpeak is proudly sponsored by Business with Pleasure, a full-service business center in Felton offering color printing, design, computer rentals, delivered office supplies, shipping via FedEx, UPS, DHL, and more. Details at businesswithpleasure.com. GeekSpeak is also supported by Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue and online at santacruzelectronics.com. Miriam Ills will be our special guest on Monday night at the Opera, presenting a program of Sweet and Low, focusing on the lower voices, mezzo, baritone, and bass. Monday evening at 7 p.m. on Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP. You're listening to KUSP Central Coast Public Radio. This is GeekSpeak. We're finishing the program. Coming up next is Open Road with Matt Pierce. I see him floating around getting some great music together. Later on, Charlie Lang's going to be here at 1 p.m. with Two Steps from the Blues. GeekSpeak is supported by Natural Selection Furniture. Natural Selection Furniture is open Tuesday through Sunday at 607 Soquel Avenue between Ocean Street and Branca 40 in Santa Cruz, and online at naturalselectionfurniture.com. For KUSP and GeekSpeak, I'm Lyle Troxell. I thank you very much for listening.